Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of the Government Operations Committee to order. We do have a quorum. So the first item of business is the approval of the minutes of the March 28th meeting. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes? How about Representative Cagle? Have you had a chance to review the minutes?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Cagle moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries kind of unenthusiastically. So that's covered. At the end of the last meeting, I thanked a bunch of people. I was so focused on a couple specific people, I forgot our great researchers on both sides. So while people are still here, I do want to acknowledge Amine on the DFL side and Joe Marble, who looks a lot younger. Brian, it's nice to have you here today. But if you could please pass along our appreciation to Joe as well, that would be great. Yeah, and my son Joe is here too. He just heard his name, I think. So we'll see how he does over the course of this meeting, which is bound to be super exciting. So Representative Elkins, I think Representative Nash is not here. You're going to present his bill. So we actually have three bills of yours.
Yep.
Is there one you would like to take first?
We can do them in the order in which they're listed in the agenda.
Okay, that's fine. So listed first is House File 2808. And I understand, would you like to move this? I understand it's going to Ways and Means.
I think so. I think that's correct.
Yes. Okay. Representative Elkins moves that House File 2808 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. There's an amendment. Is it yours? Did you want to move that first?
There will be an amendment to be discussed, I think, Representative Mason.
Okay. Oh, that's right. That's this. Yep. Okay. I remember that. Okay. So would you please present your bill?
Yes, thank you. So a little background on this one. This is a clone of House File 1358, which was originally referred to State Government Finance and was heard there on February 28th. And at that time, it was laid over for possible inclusion in the State Government Finance bill with instructions, actually some very helpful constructive feedback from members of the committee to flesh it out by adding governance provisions and governance and administration provisions. So the 2808 is in the form that includes now those the governance provisions and the administration. So the grant will be administered by the Department of Administration. And this being Minnesota, the stakeholders group that I convened to advise me on this bill, of course, recommended setting up a committee, which is why we're here today. Okay. It was because these are grants to local governments. The bill was also heard in local government yesterday. And we had a spirited discussion there, including a discussion of whether these grants should just be a one-time appropriation or a standing program that would be part of the base for state government finance. And Representative Kosnick suggested an amendment which would have been substantive, and so it could not be accepted on the floor there. But we made a commitment to him that we would offer it as a formal amendment to be discussed here today, and that's that will be the amendment that the representative will put on the floor for discussion. Since yesterday, I reached out to the various stakeholders to get their opinion about whether this should be a one-time program or should have tails. And the unanimous opinion of them is that because the amounts are small and the need is great, that this should be an ongoing program. And I think that there are a few stakeholder organizations that would like to testify to that effect today. So I know that Dave Fenley from the Council on Disabilities is here today, and I think there may be testifiers from the counties and possibly the cities as well.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Okay. Why don't we go to testimony first, and then we can do member discussion and amendment if that ends up getting offered. So, David Fenley and Leah Patton are the two who I have signed up in advance. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. David Fenley. I am the ADA Director at the Minnesota State Council on Disability. I would like to reiterate what Representative Elkins said. The need is great. This is a problem that people don't even know exist. It is a problem that has seen exponential growth across the country over the last 2 or 3 years. Last year, we had a tripling in website accessibility lawsuits. In 2017, you had 700 lawsuits. In 2018, you had over 3,000 lawsuits. This is something that's not going away. I would love to see Minnesota get on the forefront of this problem and start to educate its public entities so they don't get sued. Our agency has resources, free resources available, but sometimes this work takes training, it takes remediation, and this bill would essentially do that for a small price tag.
Okay, thank you. Let's see, did Leah Patton, did you want to speak? Okay. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Leah Patton. I am here testifying on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties and in my capacity as Executive Director of the Minnesota County IT Leadership Association, or MNKITLA, which is the longest acronym in the world. Let's see here. So the way counties connect and serve our communities through our websites is ever-changing, and that presents a lot of opportunities and a lot of challenges to make sure those websites are accessible to every member of the communities that we serve. We believe that this grant program will be particularly helpful to counties in greater Minnesota who have limited resources. Oftentimes, these counties only have they might not even have a full-time IT director on staff. That individual's time can be split between IT management and HR or accounting or payroll duties as well. Some counties manage their own websites in-house instead of having that ongoing cost of website management outsourced to a contractor or a vendor or something like that. If the individual's primary profession prior to county government is not IT, that kind of accessibility training may not be present for them to make sure that their website is managed well and is accessible to every need that there may be in their community, especially when more and more content is being uploaded onto those websites by various county departments who may also not have that training in terms of what formats those documents or forms need to be in. We think that coupled with ongoing education on accessibility standards and how to maintain a compliant website, our hope is that this grant program will help every county in our state provide a website to its citizens that is accessible and functional for every member of that community, regardless of their specific needs or unique abilities. And I'd like to thank you for the opportunity of speaking to you today.
Thank you, Ms. Patton. Is there anyone else who would like to speak on House File 2808? Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please come forward, present your testimony, identify yourself and present your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Irene Gao. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. As many of you know, the League is a membership organization comprising 833 of our 853 cities. And when it comes to this particular issue, it is a wide-ranging when we're thinking about different city websites, ranging from our smallest city of Funkley, which is 10, all the way to our largest city, and the capacity to either one, to have a website, because unfortunately there are still some cities that don't, but then to ensure that they're accessible also ranges. We've had many great, when we had the stakeholder conversation, we had many great ideas that we talked about in terms of how could we have the largest impact for this nominal amount of money. And so any effort that the state can ensure that it's ongoing money will help ensure that it's accessible to all of the residents within each city and each county. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Gao. Representative Kwong, can you be first on the list?
Yeah.
Okay, after testimony. Okay, thank you. Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Matt Ealing, Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. I'll be very brief. We support the aims of this legislation. We support this coming forward. I've had many conversations over the course of time with folks like Mr. Heller, who may be testifying today, about the need for increasing website accessibility. Our organization tries to encourage the legislature to expand access to governmental information and governmental process to all Minnesotans so that they may participate fully in the process of governance of their state. And so we think this this takes a step in that right direction. We'd also like to commend the author for adding a provision that allows for open meetings to be held within the council that is being formed. We think that's a critical transparency issue overall. So thank you again for the time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Ealing. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 2808? Welcome, Mr. Heller. Please identify yourself, even though I just sort of did, and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Rick Heller. Thank you for allowing me to testify in your committee today, members as well. Unofficially represent the twice exceptional and people with print disabilities found in House File 24 on page 167. Also found on twice exceptional, also found on Minnesota Statute 120B15, gifted and talented programming. Regarding website accessibility, I think, as we know, the legislature is currently going to have a bill going to be completed here in 1962, and this is important because it has to do with federal law from 501 to 508, and then being an equal opportunity employer, that's an important piece as people start utilizing the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act 2014. If you're aware of it, they did rule writing shortly after that, and then Department of Justice closed those books and didn't go any further with regulations. So a lot of people that want to go into the workforce, maybe working for cities and states, and they weren't able to implement that. But Minnesota perhaps can, but this working group can do that. One thing about open meeting law, hopefully in the future you will consider what the word electronic means as we move ahead in the 21st century and how individuals acquire that information and how they engage and interact as well as enjoy those same services that are provided in the workforce as well as they work with those people that are employed for state and local and city as well. So one thing I do believe is missing in this is Minnesota Statute 16E.03 Subdivision 9. It's not in the bill. It does talk about a chief accessibility officer, but it's inferred. It's not direct. Unless we target that specifically, I think at least we're all on the same page, including like 508 refresh. That's what the smartphones now all being compatible and usable with the internet, and they all read out loud. So is it really that we can read? I say it is not. I say it is that people can effectively acquire the printed word through oral, ultimately for employment and economic self-sufficiency. Thank you for this opportunity to speak. I do suggest that you also post your documents in a timely manner. I don't believe some of these documents, handouts you have, are not there. Again, that's a different discussion at a different time. Thank you for this opportunity to speak on the bill.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Heller. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 2808? Okay, seeing none, member discussion. Apologize, Representative Quam. I think actually Representative Mason was first on the list, and then I will call on you second.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as Representative Elkins has said, we did discuss this bill yesterday in local government. There seemed to be some, and the issue had to do whether this was a one-time appropriation or continuing. And because this is a substantial change, the thought would be to give it this amendment at least 24 hours as close as we could before it was introduced. So, again, Representative Kosnick wanted to introduce that and add on that these would be one-time appropriations. So I move the A1 amendment.
Representative Mason moves the A1 amendment. I appreciate your diligence, Representative Mason, and keeping your word to your counterparts on the other side of the aisle. I didn't exactly hear it that we would accept the amendment necessarily, just that it would be off, you know, it would be offered and discussed and considered. And I know Representative Elkins, I believe you had an opportunity to talk to some of the stakeholders about this. So
yeah,
do you have any thoughts about the amendments?
I reached out to the stakeholders who helped put the bill together, and several of them just testified. In the basis of what we've learned, I recommend a vote against the amendment. But we should have, as we promised Representative Kosnick, a full discussion of the issue.
Okay. So the amendments being offered in order to keep the word, I mean, personally, I will not be supporting it. It sounds like there is a need for these grants to be ongoing beyond this biennium. Representative Quam, I don't know if you wanted to talk to the amendment or if you want to wait till the amendment is dispensed with before speaking.
To the bill as a whole, Mr. Chair.
Okay, sure. So is there discussion to the amendment? Okay. Seeing none, as I said, I won't be supporting it, but I appreciate, Representative Mason, that you're offering it. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. The amendment does not prevail. Okay, so to the bill, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author and the stakeholders that testified. During a couple of my terms here, I attempted to get something through that basically said if a citizen came up to local government, a county, a city, and said, I want to see what your policies, procedures, et cetera, statutes, you know, whatever the city has done, ordinances, that they would either be given a copy or handed a card with the website of which they could find it, because the citizen ought to be able to understand the rules they're running at. And I also felt it was good that we document, because we have a lot of people retiring. The comeback was huge fiscal cost because a lot of cities don't have that. Now, I see that you're trying to address the website capability. I would wish that one of the things they look at is the state could have a hosting, a small city, small county could have a pages on a branch underneath that, and that way a lot of the overhead could be leveraged by the state doing it. There would be templates that make it easier for the cities to do. In fact, I had even had some discussions about there'd be some funds to have interns over the summer that would be hired to help out, the small cities for data entry and some of that editing. I know that that's in the future. Hopefully, if things develop. But did you have any comments on this is starting a step of where you think through your discussions that this might lead us?
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I have. And in my conversations with the stakeholder group, I've expressed a wish that among the things prioritized in the grant program would be things that would essentially be able to serve as templates. So one government would be the guinea pig, and establish a template that could be used as a best practice. There should probably be a grant prioritization for IT cooperatives like LOGIS, where one entity is providing services to a great number of local governments on a subscription basis, so that the impact would be spread more widely. So, yes, I agree with everything that you just posited, and I intend to, stay engaged with this initiative personally. I promised the Council on Disabilities that I would work with them, for example, this summer, just seeing if these sections in our state statutes could be rendered in a more understandable form so that it would not be as confusing as it is to local governments. But reiterate or to enforce what Mr. Fenley said, I've been working in information technology for 25 years as a solution architect and information architect, and I know very little about this myself. So I intend to take this opportunity to learn about the subject myself. I intend to stay with this general issue, and I agree with you 100%, Representative Flom. Yes. And I would also point out that Chair Nelson does have a separate bill, which is included in his omnibus finance bill that would bring the state legislature's website up to meeting the ADA requirements as well. We ought to be eating our own dog food in this regard, and we ought to be living up to the same standards that are expected of other branches of government as well.
Thank you. Representative Quam?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would note that he referenced dog food and not caviar.
Fair enough. Is there any additional member discussion? Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the bill author, small business is also struggling with this, and I don't want to go beyond the scope of the bill, but I do think that it might be good if indeed this is going on, especially at a local level, because a lot of these may be smaller cities, to keep the local business community aware of what they're doing, and maybe they could kind of partner locally because they're sharing this same difficulty, and as you know, there's been some what I would refer to as not good lawsuits relative to this as a lawyer making money type thing that costs these people a lot of money, and they may have an interest in partnering as well.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would say that I think a lot of the templates or the work that this group will do should be able to identify particular software package that is easier to make accessible than others, and that those learnings should be applicable to small businesses as well. I agree.
Okay. All right. Any additional member discussion? Okay. Seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Elkins?
No, I think this is going to be a very, very worthwhile program. We're starting it small. There will be annual reports, and I'll get my personal commitment that is part of the ongoing annual reports that are given. If the bill needs to be tweaked along the way, that I'm fully prepared to do that.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Representative Elkins renews his motion that House File 2808 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Representative Elkins, you have House File 1977.
Yep.
I believe that is also going to Ways and Means. Would you like to move it?
Yes, I so move, Mr. Okay. Chair.
Representative Elkins moves that House File 1977 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Please present your bill, Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hold on one second here. This one was brought to me by the MNIT under... in their current state laws, expressed in the House Research Overview, state contracting law prohibits agencies from entering contracts that are supported by barter arrangements with a few exceptions. This bill adds contracts for state-owned optical fiber to the list of exceptions. So the last hearing of this, I went back to MNIT with more particulars and learned that there's only actually one case that this is applicable. Apparently, when stretches of I-94 were built, a fiber optic cable was laid along the highway and is currently owned by the state. And that's kind of an important trunk line. And what MNIT has found is that they are able to extend the state's access to broadband capability by basically swapping capacity on this line for capacity that other entities, private businesses in some cases, have to extend the reach of the state's broadband network. So this has no budget impact. But it just gives MNIT the flexibility to basically trade excess capacity on that particular line to other entities in order to extend the reach of our broadband network.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. I have I do have one testifier on the list, of Brent Christensen. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, for the record, my name is Brent Christensen, and I'm the President and CEO of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance. We represent 45 rural broadband providers in the state of Minnesota. I want to testify in favor of this. I understand there's some agreement to tighten up the language to make it specific to that section of fiber along I-94, but this is very important. If this does not happen, a lot of broadband providers that serve northwest Minnesota, northern Minnesota, and even parts of central Minnesota cannot trade fiber on that route. And so without that, we will lose a lot of our backbone and our connectivity that we need to get to Minneapolis. So this is a very specific bill that deals with a very specific issue. We did ask, and we understand that there's some conversations going about tightening up the language to make it just for that fiber along I-94. But once that's completed, we fully support this, and we strongly need this.
Did you have a comment, Representative Elkins?
Yeah, to that. I did receive an email from Dana Bailey and MNIT suggesting a very simple oral amendment that would clarify that. And I just note what it is, and the committee can decide whether or not it is in fact suitable for an oral amendment and whether to accept it. But on line 1.11, after the words state-owned optical fiber, they would add the words along the I-94 interstate, comma.
I-94 interstate, what was the last word?
Just along the I-94 interstate, and then the comma, comma appears there.
Is that Mr. Gehring or Ms. Dyson, is that kind of sufficient for your understanding? Mm-hmm. Members, this would narrow the scope of the bill. Yeah, Representative Nelson, just curious
Mr.
what your
Chair
thoughts about
and Representative
it.
Elkins, and to the testifier, I didn't catch the name. Do we have other interstate-owned fiber that's not along the I-94 corridor, or
no?
Or is this the only one that really is important? I guess that's the question.
Yeah, Mr.
Representative Elkins.
Eichten and Ms. Bailey informed me that, nope, this is the only one.
Mr. Gehring?
I'll just confirm with Ms. Dyson. We think both agree probably it would be good to just clarify that I-94 is kind of the colloquial way of referring to that interstate, but it might be a trunk highway or it might be a federal
interstate
official designation of some kind, so we should probably make
interstate
sure.
Interstate I-94 would okay. Probably be the formal name for it.
Mr. Gehring? Ms. Dyson?
Mr. Chair, so I think what we could do is you could adopt the amendment as being suggested here, and then perhaps like direct staff to figure out the right.
Sure, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understand that we don't have the dark fiber we had 5-10 years ago, but the ongoing cooperative possibility with construction along the different routes, it'd be nice to have the flexibility with the cooperative effort. Be able to do some of that work because, frankly, as we do regional trunk highway and other work, there may be advantageous things to where the state would do the fiber, possibly at a better cost, and then there would be an arrangement afterwards. Are we restricting options in the future? I'm just thinking, making...
Yeah.
Capability for future.
Sure. Yeah. Representative Elkins?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, I think certainly it could make sense. I know we had these kind of discussions within the city of Bloomington about whether it would make sense as we're reconstructing streets to at least lay conduit so that people could pull fiber, various providers could pull, fiber through it, more easily and cost-effectively. So that might be a bill you and I can work on.
Mr. Christensen, did you have a comment?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Quam. The other thing I probably should have said at the outset is what makes this unique is this is for bartering arrangements over $100,000. The agreement that's currently in place that Minute has predates that law, and that agreement is coming due. And that's why we have to do this, because that agreement is going to expire, and under current law, it wouldn't be legal. So without this change. So this is going to allow us to continue something that's happening. And there are a lot of bartering arrangements or a lot of agreements that go between providers and the state. None of them go over $100,000, and that's where that cap is. So that's why this is a very unique situation, and they're applying, in my opinion, a scalpel to solve the problem.
Okay. Representative Vogel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And not to get into the amendment language too much, but if you look at just putting currently in front of state and skip the I-94 thing, would that work as well? And it would address what, as I understand it, it's the only thing that's there now. If we say currently, I probably have some reservations having the state get into the fiber business, so I don't have a problem with this, but I'm always looking to close the gap as much as possible, and that way it gets your I-94 out of it. It doesn't allow expansion along I-94, which could happen, and just say what's there is there.
So Representative Vogel, if I understand you correctly, you would propose that
after
the
comma,
state-owned optical fiber currently along the I-94 interstate? Or
I think what he's suggesting is just say currently owned state.
Just put currently after state lottery, comma, put currently
owned optical fiber.
Mr. Gehring?
Chair, Representative Vogel, so what I would suggest there is just to avoid confusion, we would want to have a specific date referenced in the language, not just currently, because this will be a permanent statute. So you could say subdivision does not apply to state-owned optical fiber or optical fiber owned by the state as of the effective date of this section would be the way that we would probably do that.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, Representative Elkins.
That sounds good.
Okay. So this hasn't met the amendment deadline. It seems like a pretty straightforward technical fix. Are members okay with that? Is there any? Maybe I should just ask if there's any objection to adopting it as is. Okay, it seems like there isn't. So any?
I think this Chair Nelson, isn't this incorporated into the state government omnibus bill?
Representative Chair Nelson.
I believe so, and if it is, we may have to include that in an author's amendment going forward, but
okay.
that can be arranged.
Okay. All right. So
speaking chair of the author,
maybe you should House Research should just restate the amendment just so we're clear what we're voting on.
So, Mr. Chair, as I understand, the proposed amendment then would be on line 1.11, delete state-owned, and then after optical fiber, insert owned by the state as of the effective date of this section.
Along the I-94 interstate? Oh, got it. Okay, that's right. So we don't even need that if that's
so. So the whole sentence would read, the subdivision does not apply to the state lottery, optical fiber owned by the state as of the effective date of this section, or private aquaculture businesses.
Glad I asked you for clarification. So any additional discussion to that amendment? Okay, seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the amendment carries. I think we were still on testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 1977? Okay, seeing none, any additional member discussion? Okay, seeing none. Any closing words, Representative Elkins?
Nope, I think everything needs to be said has been said. So.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So with that, Representative Elkins renews his motion that House File 1977, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. So finally, Representative Elkins, I believe you are also presenting Representative Nash's House File 1949.
Yep. Yes, I am, Mr. Chair. Okay. So, Representative Nash has a doctor's appointment this morning, so I'm a co-author on this bill and agreed to present it for him. So, basically, the intent of this bill is to promote the state's use of what's called cloud computing, and in principle, this is consistent with the direction that MNIT has been going anyway. So this just gives their existing strategy some oomph. The language within this bill through lines. I think, we have an amendment being circulated. So parts of this bill, and I'm not sure exactly where the cutoff is. Mr. Gehring, do you know is? No?
Here,
to line 15.
Sure, so with...
Here we go.
So through line 2.18, everything above line 2.18 is what's included in the state government finance bill currently, and everything after that was deleted by the state government finance committee.
Right. So everything above 218 is included in the state government finance bill. So the original bill, which included everything beyond that, apparently had a very large fiscal note associated with it, which precluded it from being included within the state government finance bill. So the amendment would bring this bill into line with the provisions that are in the state government finance bill, which do not have a fiscal consideration. So it's basically the policy provisions. Representative Nash was those changes were acceptable to Representative Nash and state government finance in order to get the policy provisions to be able to move forward despite the fiscal note for the rest of it.
Thank you, Representative. So it is your intention to propose an amendment to delete that, or I mean, I suppose could we also just approve? Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
there's only one amendment.
There's an A1 amendment, and I think we can consider that to be an author's amendment. Basically, that I think it was just passed out. An additional copy.
Oh, okay. Okay, got it. All right. Yeah. I'm sorry. I just didn't.
So we can. I think.
Oh, yeah. I found it.
Can treat this as an author's amendment. This will bring it into the form that is what the author's intent in order to make it consistent with what has been included in state government finance omnibus bill.
Okay. So Representative Elkins moves the A1 amendments. Is there a discussion? Chair Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, if I remember right, the fiscal note was like $5.3 million for this the second half of this bill. The cloud computing part did not have a cost. So we included it in the state government finance bill, but the other parts of it, we couldn't move forward with it because it wasn't accounted for. It would have busted the target. So,
sure. Okay. Is there any additional discussion to the A1 amendment? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. The amendment is adopted. Okay. Did you have any additional?
Just to note that MNIT did review the provisions that are surviving, and it is they're acceptable to them as well.
Okay. Is there anyone who would like to testify on House File 1949? Okay. Seeing none, is there any member discussion? Okay. Seeing none, Representative Elkins, any closing remarks?
Nope. Just renew the motion.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So Representative Elkins renews his motion that House File 1949, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. So thank you, Representative Elkins. So I think Representative Barr was in the room next, and I know he has somewhere to go, so I think I'm going to turn to him, I think, for the informational hearing on House File 986. So welcome to the committee, Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. And since this is an informational, I guess I'm not moving my bill anywhere.
Yeah.
And the general idea behind the bill is that we currently have Article 4, Section 17 of the state constitution requires all bills to be of a single subject, and the subject shall be expressed in its title. And in the 1858 ratification debates, a man named Mr. Meeker made the argument, and this is the only, there's one paragraph in the entire ratification debate on this particular topic, and it was to prevent the practice of log rolling, which was currently being practiced in the territory and other states, and it was unanimously agreed to, and that was the entire purpose. Now, over the course of time, our state Supreme Court has managed to wedge this open a little bit, so as we put anything we put in the title, we can put in the bill, and we keep expanding and keep expanding to the point where in 2015 in Otto v. Wright, government operations is not too broad of a title. Everything we do in the legislature is a government operation. Henceforth, we can put everything we want into one bill. There is no such thing as a single subject clause, according to the state constitution, a state Supreme Court any longer. There should be a couple of a graph probably in your packet that was handed out, and you can see in the 73-74 biennium, the legislature actually passed and the governor signed into law 1,366 different bills, different pieces of legislation. And since that time, that's when the state Supreme Court started wedging this open. And since that time, we have continued to pass less and less bills as the government has exponentially grown to the point where last biennium we set a modern-day low of 189 bills to run the entire government. And then, so that's the purpose of this amendment, is to bring some clarity and some consistency back, or some relevance back to the single subject clause, so that this the amendment, actually there's a amendment to the amendment to fix another problem, but It has two main elements in, if you look at the DE amendment, there's two main elements in here, and the first one is that once a bill is introduced, there will be, you can't add to the title. So we could never roll multiple pieces of legislation together. You could take pieces out, make it smaller, make the scope of the bill smaller, but we could never grow a bill. So you'd either have to reintroduce a new bill or just take what you have. You could not grow. So if you wanted an entire HHS omnibus bill, which currently sits at approximately 1,100 pages as of last week after the committee amended it, that would have to be introduced as 1,100 pages long, as opposed to taking one vehicle bill and putting however many bills they rolled into that thing. Since I don't sit on the committee, I don't know how many were actually rolled in. My guess is around 100-ish. I know that Judiciary Committee, we rolled 15 bills into our finance, and we rolled 11 into our policy bill. The second piece of the DE amendment has to do with the funding, and it says that if the state Supreme Court found any bill in violation of the single subject clause and it had a funding element to it, that the governor would be required to call a special session of the legislature to address the problem. The original was funding at current levels. Any program that's currently in place, if it was struck down under the single subject clause, then the funding would continue at 95%, which created a constitutional problem of a court spending money, and the Constitution says that only the legislature has the power to spend money, so this fixes that problem. And with me I have Eric Cardall, who would also like to testify on the bill.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. So if you could keep your testimony to a few minutes, I think that would be helpful. We do have one bill.
Yeah, Chairman and members of the committee, I'm just here to help. I've litigated in the courts.
If you could please identify yourself.
Eric Cardall. Okay. I'm an attorney. I've basically made a career out of suing the government, state agencies, townships, school districts, cities, federal agencies. Won a lot, lost cases too. And with respect to this, the legislature finds itself, as Representative Barr said, in a position of serially violating the law. And so when you're a situation as an institution, you're a member of that institution, and you're serially violating the law, do you feel like some moral compunction to do something about it? Now, my recommendation is you do something about it, and you start considering why you've gotten in a position where even the courts won't enforce the law against you. And so the point is, why don't we help the court regulate you so you comply with the intent of the original constitutional language? This history is fewer and fewer bills passed, multiple topics in these bills. We want to get back to where it was because it's more transparent and so forth. So you're going to have to do something. Now, maybe you could do something internally. It's not happening. So maybe you do something with the constitutional amendment, give the court the opportunity to intervene, give more clear direction. And I'm willing to help anyone who's sincerely interested in drafting language, which would get us to a place that's better than where we are now, where there are so few bills, so many topics jammed into the bills, clear violation of this provision in the Constitution, but no one knows what to do about it. So at some point, if everyone just puts up their hands and says, I don't know what to do about it, well, then we get enough people in a room, and then we can do something about it. But it's really going to take the will of the rank-and-file members, because obviously you spent a career working your way up the ladder of the leadership here. Well, I mean, it must be fun, right, to be putting all those bills together at the end of the session. But we need to do something different because the people want something different. They actually want to know how you're voting on specific subjects, and that was the original intention of the constitutional amendment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cardall. And I probably should have started with a little background here, too. We haven't done an informational hearing in this committee yet. This did seem like a good candidate for it. I do think there's a issue here, a problem. I introduced a similar bill in the last session, and I'm a co-author on this one. I don't know that the language in it is perfect or that everything in it is how I'd like it, but you know, I think it is worth a discussion because I do think there is a problem. So I thought just at least starting to have a conversation about it was a good thing, and I appreciate Representative Barr's work on this. Just speaking for myself here, I don't know the best way to do this, and it's hard to draw these lines to about when it does violate the single subject clause. Obviously, the court has struggled with that and has refused to strike things down. I'm not totally convinced that a health and human. I don't think length of the bill should be the only criterion that's looked at to determine whether there's more than one subject. I mean, I'd be interested to see health. You mentioned the Health and Human Services omnibus bill. I'd be interested to see how long it's been in the past. I suspect the length is kind of consistent with what it's been in the past. So I don't know that. You know, obviously, finance bills, especially for a massive agency like the Human Services Department, is going to end up being pretty lengthy. But you know, then when you start adding in other agencies, funding other agencies, and policy provisions, at a certain point, it becomes too much. But it does seem like since this is a proposed amendment to the Constitution, we need to make sure we get the language absolutely right. So I think it's worth having an informational hearing about it. I know Representative Quam has raised his hand. I should probably ask Representative Elkins. I should probably ask to see if there's anybody else who would like to testify on House File 986. Sure. And then I'll turn to the members I mentioned after testimony. Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Certainly. Matt Ealing, Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. I'm pleased to offer comments in support of this bill, being offered by Representative Barr and co-authored by a broad group of bipartisan legislators, which is something that we as an organization like to see because it encourages, especially we'd like to see it around issues of government transparency, because it encourages the creation of a culture at the legislature that supports good governance. So we commend the legislators that have signed on to this effort. For the purpose of the record, we'd like to make a couple of observations about HF 986. First, this bill is a response to what is an all-too-recent problem. Everyone who was here last year recalls that the capstone of the 2018 legislative session was the compilation of a single massive bill that effectively encompassed much of the work, legislative work product of last year. The press dubbed this Omnibus Prime. And it created a number of problems for citizens who are trying to follow the process of that legislation working its way through. Because of the way it was compiled and the speed with which it moved through and the size of the bill, there were many limitations placed on public testimony at the end of the session. And it was very difficult, even talking to legislative staff, who are the subject matter experts in many cases, to try to track where the bill was going, what was in the bill at any given time. And so I have talked to folks on both sides of the aisle that would like to not repeat that process. And so seeing a bill like this come forward, which would streamline and simplify large bills and the compilation of large bills, is something that we very much support from a public policy standpoint. The second point we'd like to bring up is that in creating the language for the constitutional amendment, you could go a couple different ways. I know this is a work in progress that folks have testified to. As Mr. Carl has mentioned, the functional problem you see with what the Supreme Court has done with interpreting the single subject clause is that it has looked to a test of germaneness and has found over and over again that most of the single subject challenges that are brought before it do not violate that germaneness test. So one thing you could do in crafting an amendment to the single subject clause is to set in place a different test, a more narrow test that you could apply to legislation that's brought forward. The other approach you could bring, which is the approach that this bill brings, is to put in place parameters around the creation of bills so that there are more specific parameters that can avoid the creation of large log-rolling bills that encompass many different subjects. So whichever direction the legislature ends up going in, we would just hope as this process continues that the purpose of doing this is looked at. The purpose is to create a process that is more accessible for the public rather than less accessible for the public. So thanks to everybody who's involved with this, and I'm happy to stand for any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Ealing. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 986? Okay. Mr. Heller, please come forward. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Rick Heller, and I officially represent the Twice Exceptional People with Print Disabilities on House File 986. I don't know if anybody's aware of this. However, on a national level, when we adopted the Common Core Language Arts Standards, We got rid of the degree of power rating, which we use on the MCA 3s. Now it's the new metric is called Lexile. It's just an informational text. You can look it up on the NAEP, the National Assessment. When you think about constitutional wording, to what level do you want to set the text complexity for your audience? HAVA currently suggests a third grade level. Any more, like another word I think that was talked about quite lengthy was the word gender. Hopefully, as you guys make this understandable in a way that the audience you're going to put that in front of, that you course plain language with helping that along as well. So those are the suggestions I have. So there's a database at the MDE that you can find out what ranges on a national level, including a local level, that kids are expected to access the printed word, especially when they're doing it independently at the ballot. And as you know, there are machines that read out loud, so you can figure that factor into it if you want to move the text complexity up at a higher level, those that use those machines that aren't visually impaired but may have a print disability. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on the bill. Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. And I know the Secretary of State does often summarize language on the ballot. So this, I believe if this were to pass in this form, it wouldn't be the only language on the ballot. So thank you.
Right. However, just so you know, the Secretary is exempt from the 16E Subdivision 9 or Constitutional Office. So it's something to think about. I spoke on the HAVA committee as well, as I still have two open complaints on the functioning of those voting machines, and that's a different story at a different time. So thank you again.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 986? Okay, seeing none, we'll turn to member discussion. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the testifier brought up the Omnibus Prime. This term we have the Uber Chair. And there's always seems to be something to make it somewhat difficult for tracking and guessing where a bill might pop up. But the issue I see when I look at this is not allowed to amend the title, but let's make it narrower. Frankly, if you're familiar with the root system of a fungi, and how that seems to interweave. If you've ever done anything with water, then it's amazing how many different agencies, different areas of government that gets into. So you can be working on a bill on water, and a natural course of the action you're trying to do in that bill, and now you're interacting with two, three more agencies, several other statutes, that you then would have to amend the title. And I think there are other possible things. So I think that restriction would need some work. The intent of single subject, some of us take the definition of a subject a little bit broader case, especially in debate. So that also is a complex. I enjoy the idea of, let's keep it the, logical connectivity, but logic doesn't seem to extend to the legislature very often. So again, I like the idea. I like we're talking about it, but just like three-dimensional chess, you make a move and you get surprised. But what might be the effects?
Thank you, Representative Quam. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I likewise am a co-author on this bill, and I wanted to commend Representative Barr on the very excellent editorial that was published in the Star Tribune about a week ago. I've clipped it out and put it on my desk. I campaigned on this issue, and I have to say that the degree to which we have routinely depart from this principle on a daily basis has been one of the more disillusioning aspects of my first year in this office. But I wanted to commend you for bringing this forward, and hope that you continue with the effort.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. And you didn't reference, say, the root system of a fungi, which I think that's the first time I've heard that mentioned. So it's a good analogy. Representative Heinrich, here.
Next
thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Barr, I just had a few questions about the, I think maybe some of the, and I might be wrong, but some of the intent maybe of the omnibus bills might have been looked at, I think maybe by some of the citizens of Minnesota, is just we can't get our work done in a timely manner, so they lump everything together and try to push it through in that way. And so I was just wondering, along those lines, what would be the implications if this were to go to the voters and we had this, whatever the proper language is at the end of the day, is there implication for either a longer session or a possibility of a full-time legislature to make sure that each specific thing is looked at? I'm just kind of wondering if the omnibus is something that some people look at as just a way to make it more efficient. So that's my first question.
Sure, that's fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep, you're welcome. I saw a couple members gasp in horror at the thought of being a full-time legislature. Representative Barr.
To the answer to the full-time legislature, God, I hope not.
Me too.
Actually, I see it as a more efficient manner to move legislation as opposed to an omnibus at the end of session. As an example, I don't know how many bills you've had through your committee, but have you laid any over? Every committee lays some over. Instead of laying something over, I don't know, do you lay anything over for possible inclusion?
We don't have a government, there's never been a government operations omnibus bill.
Okay.
So mostly, yeah, if we lay them over, it usually means they're not, it's comparable to being tabled.
So all of the finance or the finance or the policy committees, a lot of them that I've sat on, or most of the committees I've sat on, have had some type of an omnibus bill where they'll roll 2, 3, 4, 20, 50 bills together. Instead of carrying the bill and laying it over, it could be voted on right then, up or down, and move through the process. We could actually be voting on bills we saw on the floor Monday. We moved 12 bills off the floor on Monday. There was a couple contentious ones, and the last four were nobody had anything to say. The author presented the bill, no second, third reading, no discussion, voted, and moved on. There's quite a bit of legislation that moves through this body that would move in that manner. It has very little discussion, or it's been vetted in committee, and through the process, many, many bills would move faster. So when we did get to the end of session, when we got to the contentious parts, it wouldn't be tied to things that are non-contentious, things that we all agree on that should be done. We're constitutionally mandated to fund certain aspects of the government. So when that gets tied in with things that are a contentious policy issue, I will give an example from last year when we put the driver's license for all in multiple bills. It created quite a contentious stir. Well, that this year moved by itself because it is a contentious issue, and we now have a voting record of every legislator here on that specific topic. Last year, when it was tucked inside of the public safety bill, you can use any other thing that was in that bill to say, yeah, I supported this, but I had to vote against because of this. So this creates a problem when it creates a problem for the public when they go to the polling place or the ballot box in November to know exactly what their legislator actually stands for and supports. So having a lot of these smaller bills move in a independently gives a much clearer picture for the voter every November. But it's some of the things that I spoke with Majority Leader Winkler on Tuesday about this specific topic, and one of the things that I had addressed to him is if we were moving things through the process earlier, we could move committee deadlines back. We could actually move a good chunk of the finance bills, an HHS finance bill is an example. There are a lot of pieces that make up the Department of Health. There are a lot of those pieces that, the MA TEFRA, there is no reason that it's really, really hard to say that kids don't need, the special needs kids don't need funding. So there are big chunks of that bill that could move. 60-70% of that bill could be moved through the process, and the committee chair would just be responsible for keeping a running total of what money they have passed out. So when you get to done, I don't want to say deadline week, so when you got to the middle of April, so to speak, on the finance year, you would know that you've already passed a chunk, you get your target, I need to stay within this, this is what I have left to pass the remainder of my funding bills, but you know you're going to pass big chunks so that you could move big chunks of this ahead of time and have it out of the way so that when you got to the last week, it wouldn't be all or nothing in HHS or all or nothing in education. Chunks of this could be done ahead of time. And then it brings a clearer picture and much less contentiousness. But Representative Qualm, I am more than happy to work with anybody who wants to sit down and clean up the language to get to a place where we're all happy with this. Representative Freiberg and I have traded many conversations over the last year on different language ideas he's had, ideas I've had, and this is by far not a finished product, but it's a very, very, I think it's a good starting point, and more than happy to work with anybody who has comments.
Thank you, Representative Barr. I understand Representative Heinrich has a few more questions, so your answers could potentially be ready for
try and be a little
have one more bill.
Just one more little bit, Mr. Chair. Thank you, and Representative Barr, you actually did cover kind of my next question there. I was going to ask for some maybe more specific examples, not just for us, but for the public to understand really what how it kind of pits different groups against each other. Maybe you could be for one initiative to fund something, but maybe against another part of that, and it's all wrapped into one bill. I think we've had some examples of that in the HHS bills in the past. And so not to get into those specific issues, but there certainly are some things that, you know, I would find egregious in an HHS bill right alongside something that I feel like is something that I definitely support to fund. And so just at that very simple level, I guess I'll throw it back to you. Maybe if you can think of another example. I think you did give one this last time around. But just to make it very clear to members of the public and members of the committee, maybe on something that's happened in sessions in the past, that, boy, it would have been nice to have those two different subjects separated. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Barr.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm for a loss off the top of my head, but the Omnibus Prime from last year, when you have environmental provisions, I'm assuming there was some provisions around buffer strips and things like that in the environmental part, which goes to land usage tied to school safety funding. There was pieces of there was a lot of money in there, about if memory serves, it was $130 or $135 million that was going to be spent specifically for nothing but school safety. After the Parkland shooting, there was a lot of money, we recognized there was some needs for either some more counseling in the schools, school safety officers, or just hardening of the ability to walk into the school, maybe locked doors or buzzard or somebody guarding the door, some type of security to prevent people from anybody from walking into a school. That was in there was a lot of that money in the bill. I'm trying to think, there was, what else was in there? Says education, there was transportation money in there for some different projects around the state, and transportation, environment, health care, there was jobs pieces in there. There was some stuff out of the jobs committee was in there, environmental stuff. I think I mentioned that already. In my mind, those should never be in the same bill. I mean, as an absolute minimum, committee bills, but then there's things with, and you'll see this the week after our Easter break here, you will get a really good example of things that are in bills that you vehemently are opposed to that you probably voted get against in some committee, tied in the same bill with something that you really enjoyed or thought was a great idea, and now you've got one vote for both of them, and you can't split your vote in half. So we will all, in the next 2 weeks, get some really good examples of things, that particular question, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Okay. Representative Mason, then Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as far as my constituents, I have never heard anybody that really thought these big bills are an improvement or necessary. And I think the Representative Barr has done a good job of explaining the detrimental impact that these huge bills have. And I can tell you from personal experience, I think last year was the first year I remember leaving this building in the daylight during that last week And the reason we were going home early, and this may be an assumption, is they were putting together that big bill. And you can probably ask the people that were in charge of that bill how long it took them to put it together. But in my opinion, we could have passed all of those bills while we were waiting for the monstrosity to be created. So, again, I think this is a really good idea.
Thank you, Representative Mason. Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author, you've done a good job getting on paper and in some comments good supporters of your amendment, although the full endorsement might be a little bit of a challenge. Question for you, would inserting a 90-page elections bill into a state government financing bill, would that run afoul of this constitutional amendment?
Representative Barr, I mean, I guess I could answer that. Since, you know, just from a technical standpoint, since that would presumably require some change to the title of the bill, if this were passed, that wouldn't be allowed then, because the title wouldn't be able to be changed.
That wouldn't be allowed to be expanded.
Yeah, it wouldn't be allowed to be expanded. So it is currently. There's
no limits.
Yeah, so Representative Zerwas.
Yeah, no, I just, you know, I looked through the list of co-authors on the bill, Mr. Chair. You're on there. Mm-hmm. I think there are several other members that are on here that have made a habit of doing the very thing they now profess to vehemently disagree with. And so I think it would be, we couldn't go through a whole hearing without pointing that out. One more question. Your bill would not allow, this constitutional amendment would not allow a bill title to be expanded. You have a 19-0447 amendment. Adopting this amendment would probably expand and change the title of your bill, correct?
Probably have to do Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Probably have to go back instead of doing a DE, do a reintroduction instead of 986. But since this is still we're all trying to get used to how we will have to do business in the future, that's a good point out. Thank you, Representative Zerwas.
Representative Zerwas.
Just trying to be helpful, Mr. Chair.
All contributions appreciated.
Representative Barr. I guess I would just point out, I mean, I don't necessarily see a problem with omnibus bills as long as they are on a specific topic. I mentioned the HHS bill, and I do think the state government finance bill, it does relate to the topic of state government finance. You know, it's sort of, I think, one of the Supreme Court justices, well, he was talking about a different subject altogether, but he said, I don't know what it is, but I know it when I see it. And to me, like, violation of the single subject is kind of the same way. And, you know, when you do have not just one funding omnibus bill, but throw in several on the topic, to me, that crosses the line. But, you know, this amendment is about drawing that line, and it's a very tricky thing to do, and that's kind of why I thought we should do it, at least start with an informational hearing, just to make sure we can get the language in a way we want it before we are prepared to adopted in that form. So with that, Representative Sauk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a curious discussion that I'm finding myself in, simply because I'm still at this stage of participation here where I have no horse in this race. I've never been in a position to be at the place of assembling a bill or being invested in one of these bills one way or the other. But I am aware of what I consider to be normal human relations or human thought processes. I think we are, in regard to doing these kinds of things, we are very much motivated by management of power. So until you pull or can sometimes manage why or how that's going to be satisfied, then I'll go to another rubric that I'm reasonably familiar with, is that any construct that humans put together, other humans can disassemble. So I don't know that there is a methodology along the line that is being approached by you that will get you to a impact place, because the two main things are, can you take away power and or change the issue of wanting to manage power from a group that is, by definition, about how to deal with power and exchange power for purposes of your political thought. So I'm only saying that I don't see this having a practical or pragmatic evolution. I absolutely think you are on a topic that would be a very significant benefit to the legislature were it to be accomplished. There are other ways that I've also heard about that people think that we would impact our efficiency and the process that we go through. And one is, I think, still a function of process in one of the Dakotas in that you can only introduce five bills or six bills or pick a number. For some people, they are well past that all the time. And so there's no doubt in my mind that if that discipline was there, there is a point at which your thinking would have to choose another process or a line of accomplishment. Also, the idea of having a full-time legislature does demonstratively take away the use of the game of chicken. Because if the legislature essentially only ends because of a date that it theoretically is going to end by and then to start another calendar, that does take away the issues that we are oftentimes used. I mean, one way or the other, we're using the game of chicken at the end, saying, if we put enough stuff in the box, will you vote for this bill? And that's like pervasive. And so I think there are just some elements of the personality, the personness, the humanness of us that are intertwined in what you're trying to resolve. So I would only bring them up as part of that discussion. I think an all-time or always-on legislature could be another way of changing some of those motivations.
Any comment, Representative Barr, briefly?
Yes, Mr. Chair. When you mentioned the game of chicken would move to the end of it would move from end of legislative session to the end of fiscal year, and we'd still have the same game of chicken.
Yep. I don't deny that.
I don't have any other members on the list. So seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Barr?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for hearing the bill, and I look forward to working with anybody with any changes of language that you think would be a better way to word this or a better way to approach this. But most of the comments I had written I've already talked about. The only other thing, the last two things would be, if this language were adopted, there would be no restriction on length of bill. It would just be introduction. So you could throw the house in the kitchen sink in an introduction and then start pulling out from there what needed to be pulled out as it went through the committee process. And I'd like to close with my closing paragraph from my op-ed in the paper that Representative Elkins mentioned. And in a lot of ways, the legislature is like an addict, and the Supreme Court has become our enabler.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Barr. This is an informational hearing, so with that I will lay over, not for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill, House File 986. So thank you, Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Runbeck, thank you for your patience. We have House File 2066. Is the motion?
This is just a policy bill, right? There's no financial. So can I refer directly to public safety?
Okay. I believe there's no cost to this bill. Representative Runbeck, is just a quick question. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. I believe then, since it's a policy bill, the motion would be to move it directly to the Public Safety Committee and not have it go through Ways and Means. So I will make that motion. So would you care to present your bill, Representative Runbeck?
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the committee. House File 2066 deals with background checks for municipalities and local law enforcement. We're not breaking new ground here. This is something that local municipalities already do, local law enforcement. They are doing background checks on specific job categories and specific folks seeking permits to do business in their cities. This legislation, or the language here, was developed by the FBI. Well, I should say, first, it was developed by the BCA, and then it was vetted and reviewed and approved by the FBI. So it had a long process to get here. So again, it's something that we feel is needed. What it would do is to allow these municipalities to go beyond just a state background check for criminal history, but to go to a national background check. And that's the extent of it. But I have brought along public safety director at my Atlanta Lakes, John Swenson, and he will give you a little more of the details and why this came to be.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Swenson. I'm the public safety director for the city of Lionel Lakes in Anoka County. And I began working with the BCA on this matter after an experience we had in our community. It involved a business application for massage therapy. We did a background check. Current state law allows for us to do a state criminal history check, which we conducted. We found nothing of concern in those checks, and our city council approved a business license. Shortly after this business opened up in our city, we began receiving complaints alleging prostitution was taking place, at which time we launched a criminal investigation, which was involved significant resources, not only from our agency, but because this investigation brought us into the city of Blaine, a West Metro community, and also had some ties to some individuals that was on the Department of Homeland Security's radar for human trafficking. The end result of that was we had our business applicant charged with prostitution. And really, this is something that is ongoing for us with this particular location because we are continually getting new business applicants that are coming from the same flow of individuals through these ports of entry in our country. And for example, just 2 days ago, we rejected an applicant for information that we were able to glean for some implications with a previous owner. But this individual comes to us from Oklahoma. And what took place in Oklahoma, we have absolutely no idea because we have no ability under the current law to run a national criminal history check. And so it exposes our communities to significant risks, and it also exposes, quite frankly, these individuals that are being brought forward as business applicants for this. It allows them to continually be re-victimized as they're moved around the country to move this type of business forward in our communities. And so I'd like to speak to just a little bit about the process. It's been a long process to get this language. Currently, there is there's language in the Minnesota statute, and it's related to a tribal policing authority that was passed, put into law in Minnesota, but it did not achieve the desired effect because the FBI found it to not be compliant with their rules. And so in order to avert or keep that from happening, we worked with the BCA, drafted legislation, limited the scope of this, had it reviewed in Washington, D.C., and got it, quote-unquote, stamped by the FBI that they would approve this if enacted as drafted. And so from there, we brought it to the legislature in the hopes of addressing this very problematic loophole that we currently have.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Kwan, was your question for this testifier specifically? Okay. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 2066? Okay. Seeing none, we'll go to member discussion. Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the insidiousness of human trafficking does not stop, begin, or have anything to do with the borders of this state. And frankly, it is just prudent that we allow for, the national check. So I support this bill.
Thank you, Representative Vaughn. Representative Elkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions, probably. The first one is, do we have a definition in the statute for what a cabaret is?
Representative Rundeck or...
Representative Elkins, I'm not certain that we do, but I'm interpreting it to mean like a gentleman's club, strip club, that kind of a thing. So I'm sure they go under, you know, those kind of entities go under a number of different, probably, terminology.
Ms. I understand Ms. Dyson might have. No.
Oh, Mr. Chair and Representative Elkins, I don't know of a definition in state statute, but because this is referring to licensure by the city or the county, it would be part of the county's or city's ordinance.
Representative Elkins?
Yeah, to comment on we had in local government, we had a fairly extensive discussion, and I thought we had taken number 8, the driving a taxi cab out there, and it doesn't look like that's reflected in this engrossment.
No, Representative Elkins, we took out a provision dealing with the taxi drivers specifically, but left in the language to the operator of the company. I believe Representative Lean had some concerns about applying it to the drivers.
Yeah, that's exactly. So we left in item 7, which is operate, but on the next page on line 2.1, I see drive a taxi cab still there.
Okay, do you have in your packet another version of the bill that says first subcommittee engrossment at the top of it?
Oh, I see. There's two versions of it here. Okay, I get it. So I should throw this one away.
Yeah, so I believe the first subcommittee engrossment is the one where that change was made.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. So I would note, I mean, I think we're going to discuss, other things on the list belong here, but what I would say is that certainly massage services, solicitors or peddlers, I don't think taxi services, pawnbrokers are all things that are licensed and regulated in the city of Bloomington. And most of these things types of businesses are businesses where a bad actor might move from one state to another in order to stay one step ahead of the law, or might operate a chain operates in multiple states where, the applicant's, operations or background in another state would be relevant. And just anticipating that discussion, I have to say that especially if cabaret is as we've just discussed, that I think most of these things are I think appropriate on here.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, maybe just we might take a moment to talk about how, yes, the ordinances, around who's going to get a background check are developed at the local level, but I think the chief might be able to spell that out a little more specifically.
Chief Swenson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, cities, communities, counties are defining that. I can tell you in Lionel Lakes it's described as an adult entertainment dance club and the like. So that's where that comes from. I will also say that along those ordinance pieces, each city has to adopt an ordinance allowing for these background checks even today at a state level. And so if this were enacted, each local government would have to take an affirmative step to allow this to take place. This language would not require it. It would simply it would allow it to take place.
Thank you. I guess I do wonder, I know the situation that led to the introduction of the bill was massage services specifically. Do we know if there's a problem with solicitors or peddlers the operators of taxi services? I'm just wondering what led to the inclusion of these particular categories.
Can we have
categories?
The chief address that, please?
Sure. Yeah, Chief Swenson.
Mr. Chair, the list as it was compiled, of course, when I first went to the BCA, I said, let's just say everything, and we have to in order to comply with all the rules, we had to identify, narrow the focus of that. And this list was comprised of some conversations with some of my colleagues, the BCA, and specifically to your question about solicitors and peddlers, we in our community had an instance, and this was a group of individuals that was working throughout the metropolitan area. They were coming in and getting permits to go door to door and sell things, and they were using that as an ability to gain intelligence as to when someone was home and when someone wasn't home for the purposes of conducting burglaries. And that was about 2 or 3 years ago and was a significant cross-jurisdictional investigation. So that's where that came from. So all of these processes stem from cases where it proved to be problematic for local communities.
Okay, thank you. Representative Elkins?
Just a quick follow-up then. Peddlers, as the chief just said, is one area that in the city of Bloomington was a problem, and there were cases where itinerant peddlers or solicitors were going door to door, with either selling sketchy deals or casing the neighborhoods. And so the city did adopt an ordinance requiring you to acquire a license before you could go door to door, and that allows you to keep track of who might be knocking on doors for the kinds of purposes the chief is describing.
Thank you. Representative Kwame, you've already spoken. I did have a cavalcade of hands go up just now.
Mr. Chair, in regards to the taxi operator, there has been documented cases of mobile brothels, so it is not an unheard of practice to hide it as a taxi service. That's part of the reason why.
Okay, thank you, Representative Kwame. Representative Zerwas?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess my thought in reading through the bill, and then with my background similar to other members, on serving on a city council and dealing with municipal licensure procedures. We've had, when I was in the city of Elk River, we had instances where we needed to revoke licensure in the past or deny licensure. And I guess at that point, as a council member, I didn't realize that the only information we were getting at that time was only state of Minnesota conviction. I guess I just assumed that it was a all-encompassing look at someone's total criminal history and background. And so I noticed that in the bill, the language is also permissive. A city may do the national check, but isn't required to. And so, I think in my time, and this was several years back, but in my time with the Anoka County Sheriff's Office that I served in their crime lab, we worked on multiple investigations across Anoka County of pretty organized groups using massage establishments, townhouses in the middle of neighborhoods, and a whole host of a network of illicit activity to do this type of criminal engagement, but the hub for all the spokes tended to be these types of massage parlors or massage establishments, and we had cases that, from Blaine to Circle Pines, Lexington to Columbia Heights, Fridley, into Llano Lakes, and so certainly it is an issue, it is concerning, and the sad thing is, in many of these instances, the true victims of this type of sex trafficking are often migrant young women and immigrant young women that are really in pretty terrible conditions and being taken advantage of. And so Because the language is permissive for cities, I think the categories that are remaining make sense. Thank the author and thank the chief for bringing the bill forward.
Thank you. Representative Sauk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Forgive my ignorance, but is a request for a background check, is it specific, narrow, broad, fishing exhibitions? So if you could give me some understanding of what's in the line of sight.
Chief Swenson?
Chief
Swenson,
please. Yep.
So currently, dependent upon the license and dependent upon the community and what they authorize, this specific bill is only related to the criminal history check. And so currently, the only criminal history checks that are being conducted by any city or any local jurisdiction is state-based only. It does not go beyond Minnesota. This bill would simply allow for the database, which already exists, for us to see if there were convictions outside of the state of Minnesota.
Representative Sauk.
Just to follow up to that, you're exactly on. Now, if you take the next step, like in terms of the activity that is gleaned from that background check, again, I apologize for how ignorant I am of this space, but so in a search, for instance, if I had been a person that was stealing cars, but your interest in me would have been relative to an establishment like this, whether it's a liquor license or any of those kinds of things. How far separated do these checks get from the activity that I'm asking a license for?
G. Swenson.
Mr. Chair, so for example, a solicitor or peddler permit in our community, and again, this can vary from community to community, would virtually just be a criminal history check. There would be no financial backgrounds or anything like that. If someone is applying for an on-sale liquor license in our city, that would require a financial background, a more in-depth background, and to include a criminal history check. And so it's, again, community by community, and for most communities are like ourselves, where it's also based on what the applicant is pursuing. So there's variables to that.
Okay. Representative Sauk? Okay. Representative Mason, I think you're next on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I remember when I was on the Eagan City Council, we spent a lot of time trying to set up regulations for the massage businesses. That point is when they were becoming very, very popular, and typically, and I guess from my background, from where I was coming from, I'm looking at massage as being therapeutic or more of an entertaining type of activity, and there was someone on the council who was considerably older whose definition was not the same as mine. And it's interesting now that it seems to me the problem that we're having is we're going back to the really old definition. And somewhere I have a problem, and I guess I'm okay doing the criminal history check, but two things is I don't want the legitimate business owners, especially the small businesses, to be impacted by this. And also, and especially from the comments made by Representative Zeros, we're talking about many people who are actually victims of what's going on. So I guess I want to make sure that going forward, it's the actual providers or the business owners, which is, I think, was a point yesterday that Representative Lean had about the owner of the taxi service. It's the taxi drivers we want to be able to have a job, but it's the people that are actually responsible for the running of the business that we're zeroing in on, the people who are actually forcing the bad activities or outcomes.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Representative Mason. I sounded more like a question, so, or a comment,
well,
rather.
Mr. Chair, if we Remnant. Could just comment to that, to those points, sure. If we could.
So, Chief Swenson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, to the point of the, so this would be on those business applicants. On the unfortunate reality of what has been created here in the as a result of the human trafficking is the people who are actually being victimized in this scenario are our business applicants. The people behind them that are pushing them forward and moving them around our country, that becomes on the back end during those criminal investigations, which we subsequently engaged in. And so it's not immediate, but we do get there. Related to those reputable businesses that you referenced, our first complaint on this business was another massage business operating in our city. And so because one of their customers went there and was surprised by the services that were offered. And so I think there's growing momentum from those businesses and that business line for this type of, because they want to protect their business themselves. They don't want to be associated with this, prostitution.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, thank you, Chief Swenson, for the work that you're doing and for Representative Runbeck for bringing it forward. Wade Park has had a big issue with sex trafficking. In fact, there was a massage parlor closed within the last, I almost think, 9 months. And Chief Ben Root has been doing a lot of work with sex trafficking, as has Stearns County. And it's really nice to have another tool for them to use so that we're making sure that the folks who are applying for these businesses are who they say they are and haven't had a history, because most of the time they're not coming from within Minnesota. They are coming from other states. So thank you for doing this today.
Thank you, Representative Tice. Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Runbeck and Chief Swenson, for coming forward. I'm so glad that we are doing this. It just looks like something we ought to be doing, and I have heard earlier testimony that I think Representative Johnson actually gave. But my question is just simple. If this has been a pervasive problem over time, what has prevented us from having this ability to have national background checks? Why haven't we had this ability in the past? Why haven't we had this legislation earlier?
Representative Rundeck?
Mr. Chair, if we could, we have some great comments from the League of Minnesota Cities, and I think it would just be beneficial here to just hear a little bit, their broad experience with this. And just so you set this, we can set the stage.
Sure. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Ann Linson with the League of Minnesota Cities. And to your question, Representative Lehman, the League doesn't have a specific policy regarding this language, though Representative Tice said it perfectly, is that we support communities having tools to make sure that there is safety within the cities. The League has had a policy for quite some time encouraging the state to do some type of registration or licensure of massage therapists. And Representative Zerwas knows all too well that Minnesota is one of, I think, now 4 states that doesn't provide any sort of licensure or registration of massage therapists. And it has been a bit of a perennial issue for cities coming forward asking the legislature to establish some type of statewide standards, a board, et cetera. And I will be very honest and say that we partner with massage therapists in bringing forth that legislation in the same way that cities individually, as they're working on their ordinances, partner with the massage therapists within their communities to make sure that the ordinances are workable and make sense for those practitioners. Because no cities want to keep out the legitimate practitioners. They want to be able to encourage the businesses within their communities that provide those services. But what we are seeing in absence of any sort of statewide licensure registration is a very quickly growing sex trafficking industry that it's now it began a little bit more with our city clerks and our city council saying we need to partner with the state. and it is now our law enforcement. You know, the Police Chiefs Association in the past has had this as a legislative priority that their state action, as I said, we have for a long time. So it is an absence of the state having a statewide approach in regulating massage therapy.
Right, Representative Lehman?
So just a follow-on then. So it sounds like we're just Minnesota's just one of a few states that doesn't have this, is what you're saying.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lehman, this specifically, I don't know the authority to do the federal criminal background checks, but statewide regulation is what I was speaking to.
Okay. Representative Lehman?
Okay, thank you. So there's nothing hidden here. So any reason why we shouldn't be doing national background checks? I mean, what has prevented that in the past? It's just because we weren't licensing these businesses, period, and so we weren't doing any background checks?
Ms. Lindstrom?
I defer to Representative Zerwas.
Representative Zerwas, to that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think Representative Runback, the author, mentioned in our opening comments that we don't allow in the process right now. We don't allow cities to run the federal background check as a part of the municipal licensure procedure. They can do state background checks, but under state statute, we don't allow. So this would allow cities the opportunity to do the federal background check. I've worked on a voluntary registration of massage therapists for, gosh, the last 5 or 6 years now. And that's always a bill that you're humming along really good until you run into the buzzsaw of, I think it's Chapter 144, the naturopath healers. And you're really humming along until you get derailed by folks that aren't currently subject to regulation who want to stay that way. And so it's a fun ride right up until the bus stop. I invite you to join me next time.
All right, Representative Lehman.
Okay, thank you. I think my question has been answered. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And kind of building off of the question that was asked by Representative Salk, if the author or the chair can answer this, in the bill, how far back would the background check go towards?
Representative Runbeck.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Lee, I'll let the chief speak to that, but it doesn't appear that there's any way, you know, that this database is used that gets you to, you know, well, we'll just take this particular section of time. You know, I think those records are pretty permanent, but chief, what do you say?
Chief Swenson.
Mr. Chair, so this national database is governed by the FBI, and they have been the retention periods or such. So when we run a criminal history check, whatever's in that database, we see. But I also want to make it clear that there's nothing in here that would say a community, you know, if this appears on a criminal, you cannot issue. Those are local decisions made by the governing body, be it a city council or a county board. And so I am not aware of a retention period that the FBI has implemented on that.
Representative
Mr. Chair, so I guess kind of clarification for you and then to help you understand where I'm trying to go with the question. So according to the to one of our 2014 House Research Documents overview of background checks, the state of Minnesota's background checks for applicants seeking licensure by or an employment for or a volunteer position with a city or county only go back 1 year. And so my question is, if I was a applicant, are you looking at just 1 year of my history? Are you going back 3 years, 5 years, 10, 20, or what is the... How would you figure that out?
Okay. Chief Swenson.
Mr. Chair, actually, I would like to see that because I can tell you when we run a state criminal history check, if there is a conviction that was 5 years ago, that shows up on when we run those. How that works in Lionel Lakes is we simply report that information to the city clerk's office, who reports it to the licensing authority, which in our community is the city council.
Representative Lee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so just going on that, too, after speaking with a representative from the FBI, they say that the federal criminal background checks goes back 110 years. And I think that for myself, the only concern that I have, and you know, we have a handout here, is about our criminal justice system and the people who are impacted by it. And disproportionately, they are communities of color. And so I don't want us, you know, when we're trying to do something good for our local municipalities and local units of government, I don't want us to, the unintentional consequences of it to really impact our communities and, like I said, our communities of color. And I was just curious, have there been any discussions from you and the BCA on potentially narrowing down the type of crimes that you will be looking at, similar to what you did in the front with regards to the type of operation, or is that something that you're not looking at?
Chief Swenson?
Mr. Chair, so in terms of how a local government would use the information that they get, this bill does not address that. Specifically to where we're coming from with this, certainly sensitive to how that may impact communities of color, but what we have seen is that not doing this national background check has ensured the continued victimization of a segment of population of color. That is our experience with massage therapists, and they continually be, and there's no shortage. I mean, since we've shut this business down, I think we're on applicant number 7. And I suspect tomorrow we'll have a new application, because that's typically the process. 3 days after a rejection, we usually have another application coming through.
Mr. Chair. Okay. Representative Lee.
And so this is for the author. Then, Representative Runback, my understanding is that this will go to public safety. Is that a conversation that you're willing to have with the members there to see if they're – I just don't want us to look at, you know, if I – am an applicant and I have a DWI, is that going to impact, you know, my application with the city or the county? I just really want us to, you know, take a look at that, and if this is going back over there, I will hope that, you know, you will have that discussion with the members of that committee too. And another question is, do you know if the report back from the FBI will reflect if someone was arrested but charges were dropped, or the person was not convicted, or if there were expunged records?
Sure, I mean, those are
Representative
reasonable
Runbeck.
Concerns, and let's hear what the chief has.
Chief Swenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Related to expungement, if they've been expunged, then they should not be reported from the database.
DUI.
So I can tell you from the practice side of it, most our jurisdiction wants to promote business, wants to provide these business licenses. And we have, our council has approved business licenses for individuals who have criminal convictions for various things. That's not uncommon at all. And this, I think it's incumbent upon the local jurisdictions to make informed decisions about that. You know, if somebody's coming before them for a solicitor's permit and has a long history of burglary convictions, that's something that they should at least be able to have that information to make an informed decision. And we're just not making informed decisions currently.
Ms. Lindstrom,
Mr. Chair and Representative, the only thing I just wanted to add is to echo what the Chief is saying, is that the ordinances that I have seen already lay out the requirements in order to grant the business license. So once they receive that information back from the criminal background check, that shouldn't suddenly expand what the requirements are to attain the license. They're very specific to the license that the applicant is applying for.
So, Mr. Chair, just
Representative Lee.
And so I believe this question was not answered. So what about the record if someone was arrested but charges were dropped or the person was not convicted? Will that show up on the FBI report? And, you know, I'm bringing that up because I believe that court disposition data indicate the outcome of the arrest. And nationally, only 49% of arrests have a matching court disposition. And so how could we work that out that says that, you know, if I was picked up, but I was not charged or anything, will that reflect in my record for the FBI check or not?
Who wants to take it?
Mr. Chair.
Chief Swenson.
Yes, so the report we get back indicates whether there's a conviction or not a conviction or acquittal, things of that nature. It would be incumbent upon the local jurisdiction, if they have questions about that, you know, if it's an incident of concern related to their licensure process, they would have to do more due diligence, do more investigation to find out what that is. So yes, it is reported on there, but there's also the disposition piece to that's also reported on there.
And just to your earlier question too, Representative Lee, the way this kind of came here, the chair of the Public Safety Committee, I understand this was proposed as an amendment to the Public Safety Omnibus Bill. I don't think it was added at that point. I think it still needed some vetting. I'm not totally convinced it still doesn't, but at least, you know, a lot of the questions that we're getting seem to be within the jurisdiction of the Public Safety Committee. So, I mean, personally, I don't totally feel, I've never been on the Public Safety Committee, so I certainly know it's kind of the basics, but some of this level of detail is not something that I'm familiar with, and I'm not totally sure is within the scope of this committee. So, I mean, we could pass it back to the Public Safety Committee, too, with the recommendation that they discuss some of these issues or something along those lines, Representative Lee.
Mr. Chair, so thank you for your latitude. And I just, you know, I'll just end by just saying that, you know, my only concern is, you know, how could we go about doing this and not impact our communities of color, who may be the folks who want to apply for these business licenses with our cities and our counties. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep, thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I don't have all the information on who all uses the national background check, the national criminal history background check information, but, I mean, it's everybody. It's the courts are using it. Non-criminal justice agencies are using it, agencies of all kinds across the country. So, you know, if there are concerns with the information in there, now there's a lot of people who are going to be, you know, making those concerns known and probably changing that whole database. But, you know, it's a very, very widely used and enormous undertaking.
Thank you. So I have a few members who've spoken who are on the list again. Representative Elkins, you were next, actually, on the list.
Two questions.
From a while ago.
First one, comment that the chief made a bit back reminded me that as I was reflecting on the discussion we had in local government yesterday, and especially the list, as I thought about it, it became conspicuous to me that off-sale liquor licenses wasn't included on the list. And I know that in Bloomington there was one case in particular involving a multi-state liquor chain where the city spent months investigating it, and it kind of shocks me to learn now that they probably weren't able to avail themselves of a federal data related to the proprietors of that chain.
Representative Rundeck.
That's a great observation, and it would be great, Mr. Chair and Representative. But I don't know if we have the latitude at this point to add that, you know. Mm-hmm. But you're probably right. It's another big area.
Yeah. Chief Swenson.
Mr. Chair, actually, that was a discussion that we had, and there is current law specific to licensure of alcohol, sale of alcohol, that does allow for, so that I'm sure Chief Potts in Bloomington did do a national criminal history check on that, because it is that carve out is allowed in current law.
Okay, thank you. And then it does seem to me that if this hasn't been heard in criminal justice, it probably should go there.
Yeah, I guess I would be inclined to agree that the motion is to refer it there. So
okay.
Then I guess it's up to Chair Mariani to determine whether or not he wants to accept the accept it as an amendment, or whether or not it needs additional work. But I think I would be inclined to agree.
Mr. Chair, did someone move the bill?
I did.
Don't recall. You did.
Yes,
okay.
I moved it to public safety because I believe it, since it does not have a fiscal impact, it does not need to go through Ways and Means, I think is correct. So, okay. Representative Salk, you were next on the list.
You can stop me if I'm going too far afield.
No, just kidding. Go ahead. Yeah.
My concern is that we have to guard ourselves from being cavalier as to the ramifications of this kind of thing. People that get your name in these lists, we know by specific example and by the inability of us to do it better as a society, that there are people that are impacted by showing up on these lists, and the lists are not housekeeping is the word that comes to mind. They're not kept up to date. There's all kinds of stuff that just gets left over. I know people personally that are impacted by this kind of thing, and I have not been led to have confidence. Now, if you want to say that I'm out of order, I'll be happy to stop. Because this is in response to a number of the discussions that we've been having around here, and I think that the point is we're asking law enforcement to be Job. That's the fact. We don't have the either wording, law structure, or ability to give them guidance as to how to have good judgment. And then the answer that I received from the law enforcement gentleman, was that cities, through their own discipline, have to be certain that they don't go afield with the information that they have. And I think, unfortunately, that's the only solace you can give me, because I am very concerned about the impacted people in these lists. I have relatives that are going to be that are impacted by these lists continuously, and we have to be cautious that we are not cavalier about that. That's all I'm adding. I understand that it's an interminable challenge.
Any response? I mean, this sort of came up in local government yesterday also. A few years ago we passed the Ban the Box bill, just so that people applying for jobs can't be asked if they have any criminal history, at least in that initial application phase. My concern, I think I share some of these concerns as well, that potentially being on this list can have serious ramifications for people. I think Representative Nelson has not spoken on this yet, so I think I will call him before coming back to a couple others who have already.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I guess I'm what Representative Salk here talked about is a real issue, because I know back after 9/11 and Homeland Security was cutting down on or chopping down or trying to on terrorists, they were trying to prevent that. One of the names that popped up on the terrorist list that was a pseudonym that was used by one of the terrorists that was on the watch list was David Nelson. Well, I happen to have a brother, David Nelson. And if you remember the national story, David Nelson from the old Ozzie and Harriet shows, which most of the members here aren't old enough to remember, but he was banned from the list. Ted Kennedy was banned from the list because that was the name that they used. My brother had to fly for jobs, for his job at different times, and he always had trouble getting on airplanes because his name was David Nelson. So, I mean, we got to be careful when we talk about lists and going on people's lists. Now, I understand what they're trying to get at here. I understand the issue that we're trying to get at here. It's probably an important issue, but we need to be careful, because the other thing that we've been trying to do this session is talk about second chance for people that maybe had a problem in their past, and the law have 20 years that happened. They may have had some indiscretions, and now they're trying to get jobs and trying to move forward with their lives, and they've had a lawful life since then, but they're being roadblocks put in their way from them to getting employment as they go forward because of something they did 20, 30 years ago. So, I mean, we need to be careful when we pass this type of legislation. And I don't know, like I said, I have concerns about this.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Representative Zerwas, I think you were next on the list of people who've spoken before.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'll be brief because this is getting kind of long and a little bit repetitive, but I think a couple of important clarifications. The Ban the Box legislation, I was a co-author on the Ban the Box legislation that says we should allow people to apply for a job and not put a scarlet letter on their application, and so that it wouldn't be flagged and folks wouldn't get an interview. Very important. Ban the Box did not prevent an employer from running a criminal background check prior to hiring that person. And also very important, this isn't a job application. This is applying for a municipal licensure that the city has decided that these occupations have the contact with or the engagement with or the interaction with, and sometimes very intimately, in the case of massage, with their citizens, and therefore, because of the health safety of that, that there should be extra scrutiny and extra requirements placed on being issued that municipal licensure. So it's not analogous to filling out a job application, and even if it was analogous to filling out a job application, we still with Ban the Box, we still allow companies and the government to run a criminal background check prior to the offering of a job, and allow that job offers are contingent upon the results of a criminal background check. So I think that's important to get out there. Oftentimes what we're talking about and what this bill addresses is this addresses individuals that would have disqualifying convictions in Minnesota that would not be allowed, and they would not be allowed to be issued a massage license or what have you in the city that they're applying. But for they were 40 miles east of here and in Wisconsin, and they happen to be arrested and convicted in Wisconsin or in another state. And so if a conviction and the action and the behavior is a disqualifier in Minnesota, I assure you, promotion of prostitution isn't less heinous in Illinois. Promotion of prostitution or engagement with sexual activity of a minor isn't less bad because it happened in Iowa. And so if it's going to be a disqualifying conviction because the individual was convicted in Minnesota, and now the police are here saying, help us make sure that we're doing everything we can to keep our community safe. And the hesitancy to that, I think, is to me, Mr. Chair, quite astounding. This allows for the continuation of what happens in every city that issues municipal license on statewide convictions, but allows the tool, if the municipality chooses to use it to look for convictions in other states. Representative Lee referenced, I think, perhaps a partisan research memo that talked about a look-back period of 1 year. That's not been my experience at all. When I served on the Oak River City Council, we routinely had applications that were denied that were looking at 3 to 5 to 7 year old. We had prostitution convictions. We had a conviction of prostitution, and the individual was also carrying an unlicensed handgun. So the idea that there's a 1 year look back period, that's not an accurate statement. The bill asks for permission. The League of Minnesota Cities and the police chiefs are here asking for permission to check if someone's been convicted in other states. That's what this bill does. Today, they can check Minnesota. But if you promote prostitution in Illinois, we're not going to know about it, and we're going to grant you a license. Until We have a 17, 15, 13-year-old victim here in Lionel Lakes or in Bloomington or in St. Paul. So that's a concern for me. Mr. Chair, I think this bill is pretty common sense. It's pretty straightforward. I'd ask for a roll call on the bill.
There was. We aren't against background checks. We are saying the types of crimes and duration of how far we can look back matters. I think many members on my side have raised legitimate concerns whether there should be some sort of look back. I am not interested in playing gotcha on this. My inclination has been just to pass this along to the Public Safety Committee. This is the last thing on the agenda. I could also just lay it over and adjourn the meeting. I would encourage you to withdraw your roll call.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't see... I'll withdraw the roll call, Mr. Chair, but I don't see how this is... this doesn't treat people inequitably. What it says is we're going to allow police departments to look for exactly what they're looking for today for convictions in Minnesota, but also to find out if someone's been convicted in Wisconsin or Iowa or Illinois or North Dakota or South Dakota. That's what this bill does. It doesn't look at populations different. It doesn't look at backgrounds different. It says, let us have access to the exact same information that cities have access to today for convictions in Minnesota, but let us have access if someone has been convicted in another state. I think it's unbelievably reasonable request.
Okay. I don't think the concerns raised by some on my side are that unreasonable. Again, we're getting a little bit far afield of the jurisdiction of the Government Operations Committee. This kind of ended up in our lap here because of factors outside of my control. I did tell both Representative Runbeck and Chair Mariani that I would hear it to per their request. I don't think it boggles the mind to say there are some disparities in many aspects of our system, whether you're talking about educational outcomes or whether you're talking about the criminal justice system. So, there are, I think Representative Lee's questions about the disparity between arrests and convictions is a fair point to ask. My patience is wearing a little bit thin on this bill here. I do think it could benefit from some work, so I was prepared to pass it along with the direction that the Public Safety Committee, which to me seems like the appropriate committee to work out some of these issues, continue working on it. So, like I said, I will leave it at that. I appreciate that you withdrew the roll call. Representative Quam, you are next on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for the committee clarification, we're not discussing the no-fly list, which is brought up as a discriminatory thing. We're discussing doing the same thing we're doing. And frankly, I've worked over the years with Representative Pinto against human trafficking. And the biggest thing we do is close loopholes. And frankly, this bill does nothing more than close the loophole that all you have to do is come to Minnesota if you've done something in another state, because they only check your Minnesota record. And that's simply what it's doing. If you've got problems with running a background check, you've got a lot of statutes to change. This is just a loophole closing.
Thank you. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to be probably very close to what Representative Quam said. You talk about women of color, you look at sex trafficking. We have a wonderful person who's been working with the women trying to get out of the business. And it isn't just one group. It is all across the board. You can talk to the tribes, and they have a huge issue with prostitution. CC has been running a home called Terebinth House, and what it is a place for women to go to get healing and get out of the business and find their way in their life. It is very traumatic to see what happens to a woman, and not only is it just prostitution, many times it's drugs as well. What we're asking for is please help us to not give permits to businesses who will exploit women and boys and men. We don't talk about those as much, but believe me, they are there. They are in Waite Park. They are in St. Cloud. They are in Avon, Minnesota, which is a small community. This is what we're trying to shut down. I understand your concerns, but sex trafficking has no boundaries. It really doesn't. It doesn't care who the women are. And what we're trying to say is please help us to look at folks who are opening up massage parlors, who are opening up that type of business, which has a reputation. We just, like I said, shut one down in the last, I think it's 9 months in Waite Park. It was right across from the mall. It's scary, folks. If you want to know more about what they're trying to do, I invite you to please contact T. Swenson or Chief Ben Pruden, Waite Park, and find out really how deep this problem is. It is truly horrific. And this is probably scary to a lot of folks, but you know what happens to women and like I said, boys and men is truly, truly horrific. And I ask, please, that you support this.
Thank you, Representative Tice. And just for the record, nobody on our side fails to acknowledge the human tragedy that is sex trafficking or human trafficking. I think there are raised legitimate concerns about the scope of the bill. I'm not sure there is many sex traffickers being operated under the guise of being a solicitor or peddler. You know, the specific situation that led to the introduction of this bill was massage services, but this bill is much broader than that. I do think those sorts of questions would be well addressed in the Public Safety Committee. But I think we've heard some reasons about why it might be beneficial to have background checks in some of these other contexts as well here. So is there anyone else who would like to testify on the bill or speak, any other member who would like to speak to the bill? Okay, with that, I will renew my motion that House File 2066 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety with the caveat that the Public Safety Committee look closely at the language and specifically at the public safety aspects of this bill to make sure it's written to address the problem at hand. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion carries. There's no additional bills on the agenda, so thank you, Representative Runbeck. Thank you, Chief Swenson. And to our testifiers, thank you to everyone on this committee, member, staff, nonpartisan, partisan alike. It's been a pleasure and a privilege to work with you. So with that, we are adjourned.